1-800-981-8181.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, we're having another 80-degree day today, everybody. Oh, I feel sorry for anyone who's not in Florida today. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper an author whose book I have just been enthralled with ever since I got it. Steve Kemper has written a book that really I wish every one of you would read, because it is fantastic. It is called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador, and The Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Wow. Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
All right. It's a little
echoey.
A little soft. Okay.
Huh. I'm using a landline. Should be fine.
Okay. Well, look, I want to tell you that this book is truly amazing, and one that I am so thrilled. When I got it, I sat down and started reading it. It is so beautifully researched, so beautifully written, and the story is enthralling. Tell us about this book, because, you know, yesterday was the 81st anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and there was so little coverage of it that I saw on television, and sometimes other than TCM running some war movies, nobody's talking about it. Yet what you've done here, this research into what the American ambassador did during those years leading up to Pearl Harbor, are just fascinating.
Well, thank you very much. I think you're right. Pearl Harbor, we sort of associated just with those images of the smoking ship sinking into the water, and that's mostly what Americans know about Japan before World War II began. And in fact, what the 10 years previously, the decade that I write about, is full of drama, chaos, violence, plots, coups, assassinations. Japan was a hot mess back then, and our ambassador, Joseph Grew, had to somehow deal with that, try to maintain our relationship with them.
Now, he is a fascinating person, and we are so lucky, and for you, so blessed, that he kept diaries. And this is a wonderful for people, you know, when you're doing research and you have the main character, he's kept diaries for you to work with. That's a tremendous gift, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. His diary just in his Tokyo years alone runs to 6,000 pages. And then there are, of course, all the thousands of pages of his dispatches back and forth to Washington, and all his letters and all his speeches. I mean, for a researcher like me, it was like falling into a beautiful chest of gold.
Now, he is a fascinating person. The entire family is fascinating, but he's certainly fascinating because when he was appointed in 1932, so he's there, right there, you know, in the hot spot from 1932 to 1941, what did he see? What did he discover? Because most people don't have any idea what was going on in Japan or what led to the war.
Well, the military in Japan had these grand imperial ambitions to take over the Far East, to become the dominant power in the Far East, as Germany was proceeding to do in Europe. And the successes of the Nazis just encouraged this sort of global megalomania in the Japanese military, in the right wing. And so they kept pushing and pushing to expand. And there are good reasons for this. Japan's a small country, very resource poor. They needed things to fuel their massive industrialization and their war machine, coal, oil, rubber, tin. And unfortunately, the way they chose to do that was to conquer, to use violence to get it, instead of using trade, which Japan had done for the previous 30, 40, 50 years.
And they really believed that they could, well, they did. They took these countries, but they had this long-term vision that they could control these countries forever. I mean, this, where did this come from?
Boy, to go into the mind of a fanatic is a difficult thing. It came from their absolute conviction that Japan was the superior race in the Far East, and that they had a duty, a destiny, to rule over all of these people and all of these nations. And they got that idea partly from their excuse was they had a divine emperor, and a god deserves a large kingdom and deserves to be in control of volumes and populations of people. And so this drove them, as well as, of course, more venal things, such as they wanted power and money and influence.
So when Joseph Grew arrived in Japan, now he had already been, you know, in the foreign service for quite a few years. He was aware of the world situations. He was very intelligent, well-educated. But he had certain opinions that perhaps didn't go along with the standard Foreign Office ideas.
Well, that's true. I think that became a bit more true as the decade wore on and Grew got more and more frustrated with both the Japanese and with the American State Department. He was a good soldier in his own words, and so he faithfully conveyed our policies to the Japanese and faithfully gave information to the State Department. What he was frustrated about occasionally was our State Department's inflexibility, our Secretary of State Cordell Hull's seeming inability to recognize a diplomatic opportunity and seize it, instead sticking to his high principles, which Grew admired, but which got in the way of diplomacy, which is based upon compromise.
So tell us a little bit about the man and his life in Japan. How did he fit in? Did he enjoy this posting when he first got it? Did he expect it to be such a long one?
Well, he did. He loved Japan and he loved the Japanese. He said it was his favorite posting despite the failure. He said that at the end of his term. He found much to admire in the Japanese. Of course, there was much to abhor on the right-wing side. So he was respected in Japan because they understood that he was trying to understand them, that he wasn't solely an advocate for the United States. He was listening to them. He wanted to understand their position. And then he would tell them where their position had gone awry and what they needed to do to keep the United States from being angry about it. A telling detail to me is an ambassador must entertain lavishly to rub elbows with people of influence so that he can influence them. And Grew, his dinner parties were almost always about half Japanese. And the other embassies in Tokyo rarely ever invited a Japanese to their dinner parties. Grew thought this was odd and not the way to do diplomacy. He wanted to fit in. He wanted to have personal relationships that would help him deal with the Japanese, that they would trust him, they would listen to him. And, of course, all this personal diplomacy, this empathy, it can't withstand fanaticism. It gets blown away because fanaticism has no interest in logic, compromise, rationality, truth.
Now, by 1932, when he arrived, what was, for Japan, how militarily were they advanced? What was their situation at that point in time?
They were probably, in Grew's opinion, they were the mightiest army in the world. Still mightier than Germany, because Germany had not quite rearmed. It begun its rearmament. And certainly more mighty than our army and navy, which had been allowed to sort of lapse after World War I as we retreated into isolationism. So they were They were a big dog on a chain that they were trying to break, and Gru saw that clearly. And so did Herbert Hoover, president, who sent him there because he was concerned. Japan had just invaded Manchuria in 1931, the army, and the army had done that without first seeking permission from the civilian government in Japan. So that means the military is getting off the leash, and the civilian government isn't controlling them. So that's a perilous situation that needs a diplomatic response.
So Ambassador Gru informed the President of the United States, well, during that period, that Japan was arming, and they were arming quickly, and they were very strong. Didn't this have any impact in Washington? I mean, in 1932, didn't they say, well, gee, let's start a military, you know, operation here? But instead, we were just sitting back and waiting. When I look back on it and I see some of the films and how ill-prepared we were in so many ways, it's hard to understand.
Well, you know, that you're going farther back into history. After World War One, we felt like we had sort of gotten sucked into Europe's war. A lot of people in America felt that way and wanted to have nothing to do with other people's wars. And that became our foreign policy was based upon that we are an isolated nation, and we will take care of ourselves, and we're not going to take care of you. So, you know, a military response is not the best response. A diplomat like Gru would say we have to use diplomacy as our first line of defense and only resort to the military if it becomes necessary. Now, as the 1930s went on and Japan started bombing civilians and also bombing U.S. properties throughout China, missions, hospitals, schools. Gru had a list, and by about 1940, when he handed that list to whatever new foreign minister he was dealing with, because he had to deal with 17 of them in those 10 years, that list of incidents against Americans was over 300 incidents long. And Americans started to become aware of this and get angry about it, naturally. There was also the Japanese bombing of a U.S. gunboat on the Yangtze. The gunboat was there to protect American interest in China. And Chinese warplanes bombed it, strafed it, and sank it, and then strafed the people trying to swim to the reefs to survive, killed a couple of Americans. Gru thought we were going to go to war over that. That was in 1937. So all of this was happening behind the scenes, and it was making the U.S. nervous and FDR nervous, and FDR responded by jacking up our program for the Navy in particular, and also for the Army.
At that time, during that period, they built a lot of ships. The Japanese built a lot of ships. We didn't find this alarming, that definitely to be a military action if we didn't do something?
Oh, yeah. It was alarming, and that's why we were trying to build our military. But, you know, that takes time. And so we didn't want to have a conflict with Japan while they were clearly superior to our forces. Now, even Japan knew in their war games they always lost. After a year, maybe two, they would lose to the United States every time they did a war game. So that's why they devised this strategy at Pearl Harbor. We'll bomb them. We'll frighten them to death, and they will come to the negotiating table and give us what we want. We won't have to go to war, because if we do, we're going to lose. It's a kind of a stupid strategy, but that's what they chose to do, because they were gamblers and fanatics.
So what was Ambassador Drew's relationship with the rest of the Foreign Office in Japan? Were all of the other people sort of supporting his goal?
Yeah, I think I can say that the answer to that is yes. He was very admired by everybody at the embassy, as far as I can tell. People wanted to serve under him. He was, you know, more or less a legend in the State Department, considered our top diplomat. And he always, part of the reason that people felt that way about him, he would run his ideas by them. He would run his important dispatches by his close associates at the embassy to see if they had ideas, corrections. emendations. And that, of course, gave them a, they were part of the decision-making. They felt like they had a voice. And so he was very admired, and he got along with them well. No, I think he was, you know, he was a pretty good leader.
Well, tell us something about his personal actions in Japan. What are some of the incidents and some of the things that he did in Japan on a personal nature?
Well, one of the important things to me is, and it was new to me until I researched this book, was that in late summer, early fall of 1941, just a couple of months before Pearl Harbor, the premier of Japan, Prince Konoye, asked for a private meeting, a secret meeting, with FDR to try to come to some agreement to avoid war. And he offered to do this on U.S. property, in U.S. territory, immediately. And he had the backing of the Army and the Navy to have this meeting. So Gru, as a diplomat, was very excited and pushed this hard at the State Department. And he could never get an answer from Hull, that he could never get an approval for this meeting. There was, so that was one of the things he was most frustrated by. Hull allowed that idea, he strangled it in the crib, essentially, by making so many preconditions for the meeting that the Premier of Japan and the President of the United States never were able to meet to come to terms before violence occurred.
Well, Gru was an impressive person, even as a young man. Tell us a little bit about his earlier life.
Well, he was born into pretty good wealth in Boston. Family lived on Beacon Hill. He went to Groton for prep school and then went off to Harvard, as his father had and his brothers had. And then he decided, instead of going into Boston business or banking, which is what his father expected, he said, no, those things bore me. I want a life of adventure. So he went to the Far East, climbed mountains, shot big game, hacked his way through jungles, got malaria, came home, and told his father, it didn't change my mind to go on this trip, Dad. I still want to go into the State Department, not onto State Street. And he served in 14 posts all over the world. So he was that's why he was kind of a highly admired in the State Department.
And tell us a little bit, how did Teddy Roosevelt hear about him?
Well, that's a good story. Gru was trying to figure out a way to get into the diplomatic service, and in those days, there was no professional diplomatic service. It was all patronage jobs, so you had to know somebody wealthy who would vouch for you. And Teddy Roosevelt, deplored diplomats. He thought because they were fat cats who didn't deserve the jobs that they had, he didn't pay any attention to them. And so he was ignored this fellow, a family friend of Gru's, who kept telling TR, there's this young man who really wants to serve. And that TR said, I don't care. If he wants to be a diplomat, he must not have much ambition and must not have much character. But then this friend of the family mentioned to TR that in Gru's trip to the Far East, he had shot an Amoy tiger, which is a very famous large tiger in China. And suddenly, TR was very interested in this young man. Suddenly, he had character. He had, you know, he liked the active life. And so the very next day, Gru was appointed to Mexico City.
And it is funny that people don't realize that in those days, the diplomats did come from wealthy families, and there was a lot of this wining and dining business going on.
Yeah, just to cap off that story, the Foreign Service did become professional in the 1920s. Gru helped to bring that in, but of course patronage jobs continued. But the new foreign officers, he used to say, you just had to take a test. I had to kill a tiger.
Well, he sounds, you know, so interesting in the book. And as I was reading, I was thinking, oh, how much fun you must have had with this one. Because to have these diaries, to have this ability nowadays to do the research, and that you have all these things. And, of course, he was on the cover of Time magazine one time. And, you know, his role is very important and fascinating. And the entire family, the Gru family, has been a family of great service throughout their time. And of course, he was highly responsible for the post-war, what happened after the war, because he had, the right attitude towards Japan.
Yes, that's a good thing to point out. He served as on the Far East desk as the chief of that desk, and then he became Assistant Secretary of State, which is second in charge at the State Department. And for long chunks of like the last year and a half of the war, he was effectively the Secretary of State. And he tried to. He was part of the group that was defining the surrender terms for Japan, and he told this group, if we don't allow them to retain the emperor as an institution, not necessarily Hirohito, but the emperor as an idea, they will never surrender. They think he's a god, and they will defend him until the last stick is broken in the last child's hand, trying to stab an American soldier who is invading. So that was allowed to be in the terms of surrender until Alamogordo, when we developed the atomic bomb, and suddenly we no longer needed to invade Japan, and that term was dropped from the Potsdam terms, and so Japan didn't surrender until after we had dropped two atomic bombs on them. And even then, when they said we will surrender but we still must have the emperor, and Grew was part of the discussions that convinced those who needed convincing, let's let it stand, but he will have no power, he will not be a god. And that's when the Japanese said, we will surrender.
You know, one of the things that was so fascinating about the book is those years in Japan. It's a little bit complicated, but what you've done so beautifully, you've written about it, about the political situation within the country, different factions, different groups. There were assassinations. There were all sorts of sort of terrorist type of actions going on in Japan in those years that really lay out the situation and makes for a fascinating story about this period. And I think this book is, I love this book. I kept thinking, well, you know, I hope actually there's a big possibility with this type of book, with when you find a character who's not known, you know, nobody really knows too much about him. He hasn't been portrayed in movies. He hasn't been portrayed anywhere really. But I was thinking that, you know, now perhaps either you could get a movie deal and write the script, because there's also a lot of tension within the book of what's going to happen. What you know, we know Pearl Harbor's coming, but all the steps that lead up to it, you've turned into a really fascinating book, and I want to thank you, you know, so much for being on Joy on Paper today. As I said, you know, without it's sad that we don't have enough coverage of this situation, of Pearl Harbor, of what happened in Japan, because it's important. Well, we still don't seem to understand. We don't seem to learn from history. And there was very little coverage in the American press yesterday, which was a shame, or even honoring the people who died in Pearl Harbor. There was nothing. And if you don't have TCM, you know, television running old black and white movies, most people didn't even know it was, you know, what happened.
Well, I hear you. And of course, I agree with you.
And I hope that, you know, there's a possibility here for a great, you know, maybe, I know you're not a novelist, but you could be, because you're a great writer. Well, you know, you write this in a way that it's a novel. It's like, it's exciting, it's thrilling, and I hope that, you know, people will get this book and learn, maybe finally, I don't know if we'll learn from history, but you're a terrific writer, Steve Kemper. I love your, on your website, I want people to go to your website. It's stevekemper.net, okay? And nice thing, you have the cover there of the Time magazine and a photograph of Ambassador. I think it's just great, and also a lot of your other work, because you are a fine writer.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you.
Well, it's been a joy talking to you, Steve Kemper, and you never know. You might write a novel, and you can come back here on Joy on Paper and tell us about it. How about that?
I would love that. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay. Everybody, get this book. It's available online. And go to Steve Kemper's website. Look at the photo of the ambassador on Time magazine. And check out some of Steve's other writing, because he's an excellent writer. Thanks again for being on Joy on Paper.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. We're going to have a book buzz, and then we'll be right back. We'll have commercials, too.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 Goodreads Choice nominee, The Mother Code by Carol Stivers, with stellar narration by Sonila Nankani. The 2020 release is available in print, ebook, and audiobook. Now, let's download the book buzz. A virus decimates populations all over the world, and a team of U.S. military tech experts execute a plan to save humankind from extinction. Their solution involves genetically altered embryos immune to the virus and artificially intelligent mothers who can carry and deliver the babies. In the event of human extinction, these mothers must be programmed to raise the only hope for the future. A colonel's fateful misstep changes the course of humanity. And the dual timeline fast forwards to a harsh desert region where a robot mother called Rosie raises a child who knows no mother but her. As the past and future collide, a new set of challenges emerge, a battle for human survival and the unexplored bond between a child and his AI mother. This thought-provoking and richly scientific debut novel grapples with questions of motherhood while exploring human survival in a post-pandemic world, creating a cathartic experience for readers. Author Carol Stivers received her PhD in biochemistry from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and went on to postdoctoral work at Stanford University before launching a career in medical diagnostics. Her combined love of writing and her fascination with the possibilities of science brought to life her first novel. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, and it's not often that I get somebody who is an arms expert and has negotiated contracts I don't know what she's negotiated, a lot of things. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Suzanne Perry. She is a Soviet expert, and we certainly need Soviet experts at this time. I know that one of the things that she has done is that she is a control specialist. She was with the Pentagon, and she negotiated with the Conference on Disarmament in Europe. So, Suzanne, hi.
Hi, Patsy. It's great to be here.
Wow. You are impressive. Oh, boy.
Well, I like to point out the difference between having a lot of knowledge about the former Soviet Union and being a Russian expert, meaning my expertise goes back four decades. My expertise is not current. So that's just a little qualification. But I did have the really good fortune to work in the Pentagon in the 1980s and was part of the negotiation, the first security agreement after Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union in the 1980s, and we reached the first agreement with him called the Conference on Disarmament in Europe, and so I have that interesting, and it was an exciting time, that interesting bit of experience, I would say. But there are a lot of people out there now who know a whole lot more about Russia and what's going on in the last 20 years than I do, however, I'll say that. So,
well, you know, we never get tired of talking about Russia, it looks like.
It seems like it, doesn't it? It's like the bad penny that keeps turning up, you know?
It doesn't stop. And your book is called Lost Souls of Leningrad. It is fantastic, and you have to tell us all about it, because what you've done here is you're taking us back in time to, again, a period that, you know, we're so involved now in thinking about Russia. What's Russia doing? Why are they doing it? Trying to understand their mindset. And I suppose a lot of it does come from what happened in Leningrad. Tell us about this story and how you came about writing it.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. So I always characterize the book as equal parts war epic, family saga, and love story. It is about love and hope and resilience, the resilience of the human spirit, as much as it is about the horrors of war and authoritarianism. But it focuses on this single episode during World War II that has been not much written about, and the reason is because it was one of the greatest disasters in World War II. Close to a million civilians died, most of them starved to death in Leningrad after the Nazis blockaded the city and cut off all sources of food supply and then bombed all the infrastructure. Does that sound familiar? Kind of going on again.
Yeah.
they bombed all the the Nazi Germany bombed the infrastructure in Leningrad, destroying power stations and water supply and all of that. So things became extremely primitive. The story, because it's such a difficult period, I really strove to make it a little bit uplifting. About a certain family. So at its heart, it's the story of a widowed violinist and her granddaughter, her teenage granddaughter, who are trapped in the city when the Nazis pull that noose tight. And the men they love are fighting to save Leningrad from the outside, while Sofia and Yelena, the two women, are struggling for survival within the city. And basically, it's that story of struggle and survival and devotion and duty and love, and that's the basic thread of the story.
And explain why Leningrad was explain Leningrad, because some people might not even know there was a Leningrad, or
and of course Leningrad, I mean, St. Petersburg, it has the it changed names three times in the 20th century, so originally St. Petersburg, which is what it's called today, the largest northernmost city in Russia. It was founded in just after 1700 by Peter the Great. A lot of people have heard that name, one of the great czars in Russia. And it was St. Petersburg for, you know, couple hundred years. And then in World War One, they changed the name to Petrograd for about 10 years. And then when Lenin died in 1924, they decided they wanted to honor him, and they changed the name to Leningrad. And then when the Soviet Union fell, in 1991, it reverted to St. Petersburg, and it is a gorgeous city. It's a city that really was through a lot because the revolutions in 1917 started there, and then the war, you know, was brutal on the city, but it has really come back to life in the last, 20, 30 years or so. But I very much wanted to write about this episode, in part because I was a student 40 years ago in Moscow, and we took a side trip for a few days up to Leningrad. And for me, the most striking thing about that trip was going to a cemetery. There are several cemeteries, big cemeteries in Leningrad. One is called the Piskarevskaya Memorial Cemetery, and over 500,000 mostly civilians, some military, but mostly civilians, all unknown, are buried in mass graves there. And it is the most moving place. It's very unlike a cemetery like Normandy, where you see the crosses and the Stars of David going off into the distance, or Arlington Memorial Cemetery also. It's these big, rectangular, low-to-the-ground mass graves, and they only have a single marker on them with the year and a designation whether they're military or civilian inside. Yeah, buried there. And I was so moved by to think of the enormity of the disaster and all those people whose lives were snuffed out. And I was 21, and it was just a very moving moment in my life. And I mean, I had no idea of writing anything at that time. I wasn't interested in writing. I was going on to graduate school and then the career in the Pentagon that we talked about. But decades later, when I decided I did want to write, I knew right away what I wanted to write about. And there it was. So that's how the story came about for me.
Well, it's fascinating the way you're telling the story. As you said, it's also a love story. And Sophia, it sort of also touches on women's position in the world, because Sophia, of course, was with the Leningrad Philharmonic. She was a first violin, which in those days was unusual. She had been trained in Paris. She's in Leningrad, and her granddaughter Lena. So you've written the story that is all encompassing, a love story, the history of what was going on there. And as you said, in Leningrad, which was, of course, this is at the time of Stalin, it's still part of this 5-year plan. And people have to understand also Leningrad, St. Petersburg, the importance of the port there and why Germany was wanted to take Leningrad.
Yes. And, well, Hitler also had a little vendetta against that city, in part maybe because it was the start of the Bolshevik Revolution. It was where the revolution started, you know, in 1917. And he really, he wanted to get all the cultural treasures from the Hermitage Museum and other places and then destroy the city. And it, of course, thankfully didn't work out for Hitler quite. He did... He did murder about a third of the civilian population, but they held out. You know, one of the things that was interesting and difficult about this episode is that at the time, the siege, people were very much drawn into themselves. They were just trying to survive, right? Just trying to find their next mouthful of food. And to write a story about that was definitely a challenge, and that's actually why I have four characters: the two women and then the two men, the men they love, because I wanted to include all different parts of what was going on during the siege, not just the women struggling for food, but also I wanted to include music, because it's a fascinating thing that music performances went on into December, and people were dying in droves by that time, and still they had musical performances in the city. The young man in the novel, the young soldier who's Lena's love interest, Pavel, he's working outside of the city on something called the Ice Road, which is really an amazing part of what the Soviet government did to try to save the city. The largest lake in Europe is only about 25 miles east of Leningrad, and it freezes over in the winter. So they had a huge operation with six lanes of traffic, three going each direction. Just 30,000 people worked on this, shuttling across this part of the lake, this small part of the lake, to reach Soviet territory, and they brought food in that way. And so I wanted to include all these different aspects about the siege, that's a reason I set it up with four point of view characters as it is.
Well, I think it's beautifully done. It's always difficult to write about such a tragedy and the suffering, as you said. But they did continue with the music. But we're, at the same time, people are eating the wallpaper, licking the walls.
The glue. It
was bad.
Yeah, it's really, really, I mean, I don't want to give away a lot of what's in the book, but of course there are some, really terrible things that happened, and those things did happen. I mean, this book, all the incidents that you read about in the book actually did happen. They just happened to different people, right? My characters are all fictitious, of course, but it really was, a gruesome period. And I will say, you mentioned Stalin, and of course, he bears a certain responsibility in simply because he had not prepared his nation for war. The Soviets and the Germans had a non-aggression treaty that they signed in September of 1939, when Hitler then went to war against Western Europe and invaded Poland, and the Soviets were sitting tight, thinking, at least Stalin was thinking, oh, they aren't going to attack us. And by being so unprepared, it allowed the Germans to, move into the Soviet Union with great speed and force. So Stalin really bears a huge responsibility. But, Leningrad, in and of itself, is a very interesting little story. This isn't part of the book, but I, of course, am very focused on the war in Ukraine and what Putin has been doing over the last couple of decades and the last year in attacking Ukraine. And it's amazing how the legacy of authoritarianism that Stalin so firmly established, it just carries on. It carries on. I mean, the Russia had a chance to become a democratic nation in the 90s, and it did some things to move towards democracy. But now, Putin is just shutting all of those doors. And the funny thing is, he is from Leningrad. His mother almost died. In fact, he wasn't born yet during World War II, but one of his parents' sons, an infant, died of starvation during the siege. And so, of course, Putin knows this legacy very, very, very well. And to me, it's just the height of irony, right? He's bombing Ukraine and using winter, as a weapon, just like that was done against his hometown, 80-some years ago. It's really, yeah.
Freezing people and, it's the dichotomy of... You have, on the one hand, a people who are they're so fascinating. They love culture. They have love beauty. They have wonderful art. They have wonderful music. They have amazing authors.
And on
the other hand, we have this, what we're now discovering with the Russians, the brutality that is just boggles the mind. How do you, you know, having lived in Russia, how do you, can you understand this? On the one hand, they go to the Bolshoi Ballet, and on the other hand, they're doing what they're doing in the Ukraine.
I mean, of course, it's very hard to understand and to make sense of, but there are some things that sort of stand out. And over the centuries, Russians like their rulers. Let me just put it that way. They like their strong men. This goes back, you know, centuries. And so, you know, for me, it's not at all surprising that, you know, they have someone who wants to be a czar, who might as well be a czar, just about, right, in leading the country now. That just kind of fits. And, you know, Russians do, there are so many things that are fabulous about Russians. I mean, they are such family people. They are so warm. And, you know, I love how they, Russians always, you see this some in my novel, they call each other by diminutive nicknames, right? Shortened forms of their names. Like in the book, Sofia always calls Yelena or Lena, she always calls her Lenechka, which is the nickname, the diminutive. And Russians today, I mean, that has been going on for years and years and years. And if you're with your family members, with your close friends, you always call them, you know, by this warmer little nickname, right? And, you know, there's so many things, anyway, that are fascinating. And, of course, their literary life, their cultural life, it's amazing. But they do really like their strongmen. And then there's some, so, you know, you had all those years of communism, or really Soviet communism, Soviet-style socialism, which, of course, was a great distortion of communism and of socialism. But I think people, you know, during that era, especially under Stalin, they had to keep quiet to survive. They had to just keep their heads down, go to their job, try to take care of their family, and not draw any attention to them, to themselves. And there is still persists today. People, especially now after the war in Ukraine began, you know, a lot of people are protesting. A lot of people get thrown in prison, but many more do not, right? They just keep their heads down and just try to live their lives. And that has been, you know, I think also a part of Russian culture or Russian heritage, Soviet heritage. So it's hard to make real sense of and to come up with a clean answer, but
people have to read your book. I'm running out of time. I want to make sure that I tell people that Lost Souls of Leningrad by Suzanne Perry is an excellent book, a great read. As I said, you know, this is something that is timely. And I want also mention your website, because you have a lovely, you have photographs there. You have more about St. Petersburg.
The website is www.SuzannePerryWrites. So my name and WRITES.com, Suzanne Perry Wrights. And yeah, there's more on there. In fact, very interestingly, I have a blog post that I put up several months ago about Brittany Griner, who they just announced this morning is being free from the Russian prison. So, so feel free. And if people want to email me or get in touch with me, they can do that there too.
Exactly. You know, and this would be a great book for book clubs to take and invite Suzanne to talk to you, because it's a fascinating story. You beautifully written. And Suzanne, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been really an honor to talk to you. I know that, you know, you're going to be writing more and more books, I think, and there's definitely a market, because you're looking at the Soviet experience through eyes that have been well-trained with all the work that you did in Russia. So thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Oh, thank you, Patsy. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, people, it's a fantastic book. Get it. Okay? Bye-bye now, Susan.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm so happy that I got to talk to her because it's a great book. And, you know, two history books today. First, Suzanne's, you know, this book is, it's heartbreaking at times, it's romantic, it's got everything. And it's called Lost Souls of Leningrad. And then, again, Steve Kemper's book, Our Man in Tokyo, A Splendid Savage, is another one of his books. So we have two books to talk about today that we talked about. And really, well, do we learn from history? I don't know. You know, both of these books are based on historical, real events in history. And perhaps if we all start reading more, we will actually sit down and talk about what can we learn? Because this is terrible what's going on in the Ukraine right now. And just like, could we have avoided the Japanese war, the war with Japan? Could we have avoided the Ukraine war? I don't, you know, if we don't talk about it, if we don't read about it, we'll never know. So again, thank you to both of these authors. They've done a terrific job. This is part of the joy of writing. When you have books, you can do research. You have so much fun. I cannot tell you how much fun it is. If you have not ever done research on something, the fun of doing the research is almost as much fun as having finally the book printed. Just that thrill that you get day after day, digging deep into history is so much fun. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for sending me emails about NaNoWriMo. And because, you know, remember what I always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. And just like Carol J. Perry did, and her newsletter is out, and she is really happy. Her Christmas book is out. It's called High Spirits, and you must get it. And everybody, thank you so much again I've been getting really great emails from you. I really appreciate it. And say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. It was great, great just being here today. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And we have beautiful weather here. Bye-bye now.